Disc 21.
Al Gore gave a marvelous concession speech. It was genuine, gracious, and patriotic. When I called to congratulate him, he told me that a friend who was a professional comedian had joked to him that he had gotten the best of both worlds. He had won the popular vote and didn't have to do the job. The next morning, after Tony Blair and I talked a bit, I walked outside, complimented Al, and pledged to work with President-elect Bush. Then Tony and Cherie accompanied Hillary, Chelsea, and me to the University of Warwick, where I gave another of my farewell speeches, this one on the approach to globalization our Third Way group had embraced, trade plus a global contract for economic empowerment, education, health care, and democratic governance. The speech also gave me a chance to publicly thank Tony Blair for his friendship and our partnership. I had treasured our times together and would miss them. Before we left England, we went to Buckingham Palace, accepting Queen Elizabeth's kind invitation to tea. We had a pleasant visit, discussing the election and world affairs. Then Her Majesty took the unusual step of accompanying us down to the ground floor of the palace and walking us out to our car to say goodbye. She, too, had been gracious and kind to me over the past 8 years. On December 15th, I reached an omnibus budget agreement with Congress, the last major legislative victory of my 8 years. The education budget was especially good. Finally, I secured more than $1 billion to repair schools, the largest increase ever in Head Start, enough money to put 1.3 million students in after-school programs, a 25% increase in the fund to hire 100,000 teachers, and more funding for Pell Grants for our Gear Up mentoring program and for our efforts to turn around failing schools. The bill also included the New Markets Initiative, a large increase in biomedical research, health care coverage for welfare recipients and disabled people moving into the workforce, and the Millennium Debt Relief Initiative. John Podesta, Steve Ricchetti, and my legislative aide, Larry Stein, and our whole team had done a great job. My last year, when I was supposed to be a lame duck, had resulted in the passage of a surprising number of the State of the Union recommendations. Besides those mentioned above, Congress had passed the Africa-Caribbean Trade Bill, the China Trade Bill, the Lands Legacy Initiative, and a large increase in child care assistance to working families. I was still deeply disappointed in the election outcome and concerned about the Middle East, but after the visit to Ireland and England and the budget victories, I was finally getting into the Christmas spirit. On the 18th, Jacques Chirac and Romano Prodi came to the White House for my last meeting with European Union leaders. By then, we were old friends, and I was glad to receive them one last time. Jacques thanked me for supporting the growth of the EU and transatlantic relations. I responded that we had managed three great questions well: the growth and expansion of the EU, the expansion of NATO and the new relationship with Russia, and the problems of the Balkans. While I was meeting with Chirac and Prodi, the Middle East teams began talks at Bolling Air Force Base in Washington. Hillary received Laura Bush at the White House, and our family went house shopping in Washington. The people of New York had decided she wasn't leaving town after all. Eventually, we found a lovely house that bordered Rock Creek Park in the embassy area off Massachusetts Avenue. The next day, President-elect Bush came to the White House for the same meeting I had had with his father 8 years earlier. We talked about the campaign, White House operations, and national security. He was putting together an experienced team from past Republican administrations who believed that the biggest security issues were the need for national missile defense and Iraq. I told him that based on the last 8 years, I thought his biggest security problems in order would be Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, the absence of peace in the Middle East, the standoff between nuclear powers India and Pakistan, and the ties of the Pakistanis to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, North Korea, and then Iraq. I said that my biggest disappointment was not getting bin Laden, that we still might achieve an agreement in the Middle East, and that we had almost tied up a deal with North Korea to end its missile program, but that he would probably have to go there to close the deal. He listened to what I had to say without much comment, then changed the subject to how I did the job. My only advice was that he should put together a good team and try to do what he thought was right for the country. Then we talked a little more politics. Bush had been a very adept politician in 2000, building a coalition with moderate rhetoric and quite conservative-specific proposals. The first time I had seen him give his compassionate conservative speech in Iowa, I knew he had a chance to win. After the primaries, he was badly positioned way out on the right and behind in the polls, but he had walked back to the center by moderating his rhetoric, urging the Republican Congress not to balance the budget on the backs of the poor, and even supporting my position on a couple of foreign policy issues. When he was governor, his conservatism had been leavened by the need to work with a Democratic state legislature and by the support he had received from Democratic Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock, who wielded a lot of day-to-day power under the Texas system. Now he would govern with a conservative Republican Congress. He had to choose his own way. After our meeting, I knew he was fully capable of getting his way, but I couldn't tell whether it would be the path he had followed as governor or the one he had taken to defeat John McCain in the South Carolina primary. December 23rd was a fateful day for the Middle East peace process. After the two sides had been negotiating again for several days at Bowling Air Force Base, my team and I became convinced that unless we narrowed the range of debate, in effect forcing the big compromises up front, there would never be an agreement. Arafat was afraid of being criticized by other Arab leaders. Barak was losing ground to Sharon at home. So I brought the Palestinian and Israeli teams into the cabinet room and read them my parameters for proceeding. These were developed after extensive private talks with the parties separately since Camp David. If they accepted the parameters within 4 days, we would go forward. If not, we were through. I read them slowly so that both sides could take careful notes. On territory, I recommended 94% to 96% of the West Bank for the Palestinians with a land swap from Israel of 1% to 3%, and an understanding that the land kept by Israel would include 80% of the settlers in blocks. On security, I said Israeli forces should withdraw over a 3-year period while an international force would be gradually introduced, with the understanding that a small Israeli presence in the Jordan Valley could remain for another 3 years under the authority of the international forces. The Israelis would also be able to maintain their early warning station in the West Bank with a Palestinian liaison presence. In the event of an imminent and demonstrable threat to Israel's security, there would be provision for emergency deployments in the West Bank. The new state of Palestine would be non-militarized, but would have a strong security force. Sovereignty over its airspace with special arrangements to meet Israeli training and operational needs, and an international force for border security and deterrence. On Jerusalem, I recommended that the Arab neighborhoods be in Palestine and the Jewish neighborhoods in Israel, and that the Palestinians should have sovereignty over the Temple Mount Haram and the Israelis sovereignty over the Western Wall and the holy space of which it is a part, with no excavation around the wall or under the mount, at least without mutual consent. On refugees, I said that the new state of Palestine should be the homeland for refugees displaced in the 1948 war and afterward, without ruling out the possibility that Israel would accept some of the refugees according to its own laws and sovereign decisions, giving priority to the refugee populations in Lebanon. I recommended an international effort to compensate refugees and assist them in finding houses in the new state of Palestine, in the land swap areas to be transferred to Palestine, in their current host countries, in other willing nations, or in Israel. Both parties should agree that this solution would satisfy UN Security Council Resolution 194. Finally, the agreement had to clearly mark the end of the conflict and put an end to all violence. I suggested a new UN Security Council resolution saying that this agreement, along with the final release of Palestinian prisoners, would fulfill the requirements of Resolutions 242 and 338. I said these parameters were non-negotiable and were the best I could do, and I wanted the parties to negotiate a final status agreement within them. After I left, Dennis Ross and other members of our team stayed behind to clarify any misunderstanding, but they refused to hear complaints. I knew the plan was tough for both parties, but it was time, past time, to put up or shut up. The Palestinians would give up the absolute right of return. They had always known that they would have to, but they never wanted to admit it. The Israelis would give up East Jerusalem and parts of the Old City, but their religious and cultural sites would be preserved. It had been evident for some time that for peace to come, they would have to do that. The Israelis would also give up a little more of the West Bank and probably a larger land swap than Barak's last best offer, but they would keep enough to hold at least 80% of the settlers. And they would get a formal end to the conflict. It was a hard deal, but if they wanted peace, I thought it was fair to both sides. Arafat immediately began to equivocate, asking for clarifications. But the parameters were clear. Either he would negotiate within them or not. As always, he was playing for more time. I called Mubarak and read him the points. He said they were historic, and he could encourage Arafat to accept them. On the 27th, Barak's cabinet endorsed the parameters with reservations, but all their reservations were within the parameters, and therefore subject to negotiations anyway. It was historic. An Israeli government had said that to get peace, there would be a Palestinian state in roughly 97% of the West Bank, counting the swap and all of Gaza, where Israel also had settlements. The ball was in Arafat's court. I was calling other Arab leaders daily to urge them to pressure Arafat to say yes. They were all impressed with Israel's acceptance and told me they believed Arafat should take the deal. I have no way of knowing what they told him, though Saudi Ambassador Prince Bandar later told me he and Crown Prince Abdullah had the distinct impression Arafat was going to accept the parameters. On the 29th, Dennis Ross met with Abu Ala, whom we all respected, to make sure Arafat understood the consequences of rejection. I would be gone. Ross would be gone. Barak would lose the upcoming election to Sharon. Bush wouldn't want to jump in after I had invested so much and failed. I still didn't believe Arafat would make such a colossal mistake. The previous day I had announced that I would not travel to North Korea to close the agreement banning its production of long-range missiles, saying I was confident the next administration would consummate the deal based on the good work that had been done. I hated to give up on ending the North Korean missile program. We had stopped their plutonium and missile testing programs and had refused to deal with them on other issues without involving South Korea, setting the stage for Kim Dae-jung's sunshine policy. Kim's brave outreach offered more hope for reconciliation than at any time since the end of the Korean War, and he had just been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for it. Madeleine Albright had made a trip to North Korea and was convinced that if I went, we could make the missile agreement. Although I wanted to take the next step, I simply couldn't risk being halfway around the world when we were so close to peace in the Middle East, especially after Arafat had assured me that he was eager for an agreement and had implored me not to go. Besides the Middle East and the budget, a surprising number of other things had happened in the last 30 days. I marked the 7th anniversary of the Brady Bill with the announcement that it had now prevented 611,000 felons, fugitives, and stalkers from buying handguns, observed World AIDS Day at Howard University with representatives from 24 African countries, saying that we had cut the death rate by more than 70% in the United States and now had to do much more in Africa and other places where the disease was raging. Unveiled the design of my presidential library, a long, narrow glass and steel bridge to the 21st century jutting out above the Arkansas River, announced an effort to increase immunizations among inner-city children whose vaccination rates remained far below the national average, signed my last veto of a bankruptcy reform bill that was much harsher to lower-income debtors than to wealthy ones, issued strong regulations to protect the privacy of medical records, hailed India's decision to maintain its ceasefire in Kashmir and Pakistan's upcoming withdrawal of troops along the line of control, and announced new regulations to reduce unhealthy diesel fuel emissions from trucks and buses. Together with the year-old emissions standards on cars and SUVs, the new rules ensured that by the end of the decade, new vehicles would be up to 95% cleaner than those now on the road, preventing many thousands of cases of respiratory illness and premature death. 3 days before Christmas, I granted executive clemency or commutations of sentences to 62 people. I hadn't given many pardons in my first term and was anxious to deal with the backlog. President Carter had granted 566 clemencies in 4 years. President Ford had granted 409 in 2.5 years. President Reagan's total was 406 in his 8 years. President Bush had granted only 77, and they included the controversial pardons of the Iran-Contra figures and the release of Orlando Bosch, an anti-Castro Cuban the FBI believed to be guilty of multiple murders. My philosophy on pardons and commutations of sentences, developed while I was Attorney General and Governor of Arkansas, was conservative when it came to shortening sentences and liberal in granting pardons for nonviolent offenses once people had served their sentences and spent a reasonable amount of time afterward as law-abiding citizens, if for no other reason than to give them their voting rights back. There was a pardon office in the Justice Department that reviewed applications and made recommendations. I had been receiving them for 8 years and had learned two things. The people over at Justice took too long to review the applications, and they recommended denial in almost all the cases. I understood how it had happened. In Washington, everything was political, and almost every pardon was potentially controversial. If you were a civil servant, the only surefire way to stay out of trouble was to say no. The Justice Department's Pardon Office knew that they couldn't get heat for delaying cases or for recommending denials. A constitutional function vested in the president was slowly being transferred into the bowels of the Justice Department. For the last several months, we had been pushing Justice hard to send us more files, and they were doing better. Of the 59 people I pardoned and the 3 whose sentences I commuted, most were people who'd made a mistake, served their time, and become good citizens. I also issued pardons in the so-called girlfriend cases. They involved women who had been arrested because their husbands or boyfriends had committed an offense, usually drug-related. The women were threatened with long sentences, even if they hadn't themselves been directly involved in the crime, unless they provided testimony against their men. Those who refused or didn't know enough to be helpful got long jail terms. In several cases, the men in question later cooperated with prosecutors and received shorter sentences than the women had. We had been working on these cases for months. I had already pardoned 4 of them the previous summer. I also pardoned former House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dan Rostenkowski. Rostenkowski had done a lot for his country and had more than paid for his mistakes. And I pardoned Archie Schaefer, an executive of Tyson Foods who was caught in the ESPY investigation and was facing a mandatory jail sentence for violating an old law Schaefer knew nothing about because he had made travel arrangements as instructed so that ESPY could come to a Tyson retreat. After the Christmas clemencies, we were flooded with requests, many from people upset at the delay in the regular process. Over the next 5 weeks, we worked through hundreds of requests, rejecting hundreds more and granting 140, bringing my 8-year total to 456 out of more than 7,000 petitions for clemency. My White House counsel, Beth Nolan, Bruce Lindsay, and my pardon attorney, Meredith Cabe, worked through as many as they could, getting information and clearance from the Justice Department. Some of the decisions were easy, like the cases of Susan McDougall and Henry Cisneros, who had been horribly mistreated by independent counsels, more girlfriend cases, and a large number of routine requests that probably should have been granted years earlier. One of them was a mistake based on inadequate information because the Justice Department didn't know that the man in question was under investigation in a different state. Most of the pardons were for people of modest means who had no way to break through the system. The most controversial pardons went to Mark Rich and his partner, Pincus Green. Rich, a wealthy businessman, had left the United States for Switzerland shortly before he was indicted on tax and other charges for allegedly falsely reporting the price of certain oil transactions to minimize his tax liability. There were several such cases in the 1980s when some oil was under price controls and some was not, inviting the dishonest to underestimate their income or to overcharge their customers. During that time, several people and companies were charged with violating the law, but the individuals were usually charged with a civil offense. It was extremely rare for tax charges to be prosecuted under the racketeering statutes as Rich and Green were, and after they were charged, the Justice Department ordered U.S. attorneys to stop doing it. After he was indicted, Rich stayed overseas, mostly in Israel and Switzerland. The government had allowed Rich's business to continue to operate after he agreed to pay $200 million in fines, more than four times the $48 million in taxes the government claimed he had evaded. Professor Marty Ginsburg, a tax expert and husband of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Harvard Law professor Bernard Wolfman had reviewed the transactions in question and concluded that Rich's companies were right in their tax computations, which meant that Rich himself had not owed any taxes on these transactions. Rich agreed to waive the statute of limitations so that he could still be sued by the government in a civil action as all other offenders had been. Ehud Barak asked me three times to pardon Rich because of Rich's services to Israel and his help with the Palestinians, and several other Israeli figures in both major parties urged his release. Finally, the Justice Department said it had no objections and would lean toward granting the pardon if it advanced our foreign policy interests. Most everyone thought I was wrong to pardon a wealthy fugitive whose ex-wife was a supporter of mine and who had retained one of my former White House counsels on his legal team, along with two prominent Republican lawyers. Rich had also been recently represented by Louis Scooter Libby, Vice President-elect Dick Cheney's chief of staff. I may have made a mistake, at least in the way I allowed the case to come to my attention, but I made the decision based on the merits. As of May 2004, Rich still had not been sued by the Justice Department, a surprising development since the burden of proof is much easier for the government to make in a civil case than in a criminal one. Although I would later be criticized for some of the pardons I granted, I was more concerned by a few I didn't grant. For example, I thought Michael Milken had a persuasive case because of the good work he had done on prostate cancer after his release from prison, but Treasury and the Securities and Exchange Commission were adamantly against my pardoning him, saying it would send the wrong signal at a time when they were trying to enforce high standards in the financial industry. The two cases I most regretted turning down were Webb Hubble and Jim Guy Tucker. Tucker's case was on appeal, and Hubble had actually broken the law and had not been out of jail for the usual period before being considered for a pardon. But they both had been abused by Ken Starr's office for their refusal to lie. Neither of them would have endured a fraction of what they did had I not been elected president and fallen into Starr's clutches. David Kendall and Hillary strongly urged me to pardon them. Everyone else was adamantly against it. Finally, I gave in to my staff's hard-nosed judgment. I've regretted it ever since. I later apologized to Jim Guy Tucker when I saw him, and will do the same to Webb one day. Our Christmas was like all the others, but more savored because we knew it was our last at the White House. I would enjoy these last receptions more, and the chance to see so many people who shared our time in Washington. I was looking more carefully now at all the ornaments Chelsea, Hillary, and I put on our tree, and at the bells, books, Christmas plates, stockings, pictures, and standing Santa Clauses with which we filled the yellow oval room. I found myself taking time to walk into all the rooms on the second and third floors to look more closely at all the paintings and old furniture. And I finally got around to getting the White House ushers to provide me with a history of all the White House grandfather clocks, which I used as I studied them. The portraits of my predecessors and their wives took on a new meaning as Hillary and I realized we'd be among them before long. Both of us had chosen Simi Knox to paint our portraits. We liked Knox's lifelike style, and he would be the first African-American portraitist to have his work hang in the White House. In the week after Christmas, I signed a few more bills and appointed Roger Gregory to be the first African-American judge on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Gregory was well qualified, and Jesse Helms had blocked a black judge there long enough. It was a recess appointment, one a president can make for a year, when Congress is not in session. I was betting the new president wouldn't want an all-white court of appeals in the Southeast. I also announced that with the budget just enacted, there would be enough money to pay $600 billion of the debt down over 4 years, and if we stayed on the present course, we would be debt-free by 2010. Freeing up 12 cents of every tax dollar for tax cuts or new investments. Because of our fiscal responsibility, long-term interest rates were now, after all the growth, 2% lower than when I took office, reducing the costs of mortgages, car payments, business loans, and student loans. The low interest rates had put more money in people's pockets than tax cuts would have. Finally, on the last day of the year, I signed the treaty by which America joined the International Criminal Court. Senator Lott and most Republican senators were strongly opposed to it, fearing that U.S. soldiers sent to foreign lands would be hauled before the court for political purposes. I had been concerned about that too, but the treaty was now drafted in a manner that I was convinced would prevent that from happening. I had been among the first world leaders to call for an international war crimes tribunal, and I thought the United States should support it. We passed up Renaissance Weekend again that year so that our family could spend the last New Year's at Camp David. I still hadn't heard from Arafat. On New Year's Day, I invited him to the White House the next day. Before he came, he received Prince Bandar and the Egyptian ambassador at his hotel. One of Arafat's younger aides told us that they had pushed him hard to say yes. When Arafat came to see me, he asked a lot of questions about my proposal. He wanted Israel to have the Wailing Wall because of its religious significance, but asserted that the remaining 50 feet of the Western Wall should go to the Palestinians. I told him he was wrong, that Israel should have the entire wall to protect itself from someone using one entrance of the tunnel that ran beneath the wall from damaging the remains of the temples beneath the Haram. The old city had four quarters, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, and Armenian. It was assumed that Palestine would get the Muslim and Christian quarters, with Israel getting the other two. Arafat argued that he should have a few blocks of the Armenian quarter because of the Christian churches there. I couldn't believe he was talking to me about this. Arafat was also trying to wiggle out of giving up the right of return. He knew he had to, but was afraid of the criticism he would get. I reminded him that Israel had promised to take some of the refugees from Lebanon whose families had lived in what was now northern Israel for hundreds of years, but that no Israeli leader would ever let in so many Palestinians that the Jewish character of the state could be threatened in a few decades by the higher Palestinian birth rate. There were not going to be two majority Arab states in the Holy Land. Arafat had acknowledged that by signing the 1993 peace agreement with its implicit two-state solution. Besides, the agreement had to be approved by Israeli citizens in a referendum. The right of return was a deal-breaker. I wouldn't think of asking the Israelis to vote for it. On the other hand, I thought the Israelis would vote for a final settlement within the parameters I had laid out. If there was an agreement, I even thought Barack might be able to come back and win the election, though he was running well behind Sharon in the polls, in an electorate frightened by the Intifada and angered by Arafat's refusal to make peace. At times, Arafat seemed confused, not wholly in command of the facts. I had felt for some time that he might not be at the top of his game any longer, after all the years of spending the night in different places to dodge assassins' bullets, all the countless hours on airplanes, all the endless hours of tension-filled talks. Perhaps he simply couldn't make the final jump from revolutionary to statesman. He had grown used to flying from place to place, giving mother-of-pearl gifts made by Palestinian craftsmen to world leaders and appearing on television with them. It would be different if the end of violence took Palestine out of the headlines and instead he had to worry about providing jobs, schools, and basic services. Most of the young people on Arafat's team wanted him to take the deal. I believe Abu Ala and Abu Mazen also would have agreed, but didn't want to be at odds with Arafat. When he left, I still had no idea what Arafat was going to do. His body language said no, but the deal was so good I couldn't believe anyone would be foolish enough to let it go. Barack wanted me to come to the region, but I wanted Arafat to say yes to the Israelis on the big issues embodied in my parameters first. In December, the parties had met at Bowling Air Force Base for talks that didn't succeed because Arafat wouldn't accept the parameters that were hard for him. Finally, Arafat agreed to see Shimon Peres on the 13th after Peres had first met with Saeb Erekat. Nothing came of it. As a backstop, the Israelis tried to produce a letter with as much agreement on the parameters as possible, on the assumption that Barack would lose the election and at least both sides would be bound to a course that could lead to an agreement. Arafat wouldn't even do that, because he didn't want to be seen conceding anything. The parties continued their talks in Taba, Egypt. They got close, but did not succeed. Arafat never said no. He just couldn't bring himself to say yes. Pride goeth before the fall. Right before I left office, Arafat, in one of our last conversations, thanked me for all my efforts and told me what a great man I was. "Mr. Chairman," I replied, "I am not a great man. I am a failure, and you have made me one." I warned Arafat that he was single-handedly electing Sharon and that he would reap the whirlwind. In February 2001, Ariel Sharon would be elected prime minister in a landslide. The Israelis had decided that if Arafat wouldn't take my offer, he wouldn't take anything, and that if they had no partner for peace, it was better to be led by the most aggressive, intransigent leader available. Sharon would take a hard line toward Arafat and would be supported in doing so by Ehud Barak and the United States. Nearly a year after I left office, Arafat said he was ready to negotiate on the basis of the parameters I had presented. Apparently, Arafat had thought the time to decide, 5 minutes to midnight, had finally come. His watch had been broken a long time. Arafat's rejection of my proposal after Barak accepted it was an error of historic proportions. However, many Palestinians and Israelis are still committed to peace. Someday peace will come, and when it does, the final agreement will look a lot like the proposals that came out of Camp David and the 6 long months that followed. On January 3rd, I sat in the Senate with Chelsea and the rest of Hillary's family as Al Gore administered the oath of office to New York's new senator. I was so excited I almost jumped over the railing. For 17 more days, we would both be in office, the first couple to serve in the White House and the Senate in American history. But Hillary was on her own now. About all I could do was ask Trent Lott not to be too hard on her and offer to be Hillary's caseworker for Westchester County. The next day we held a White House event that for me was about Mother, a celebration of the Breast and Cervical Cancer Protection and Treatment Act of 2000, which allowed women without health insurance who were diagnosed with these cancers to have full Medicaid benefits. On the 5th, I announced that we would protect 60 million acres of pristine national forest in 39 states from road building and logging, including the Tongass National Forest in Alaska, the last great temperate rainforest in America. The timber interests were against the move, and I thought the Bush administration might try to undo it on economic grounds. But only 5% of the nation's timber came from national forests, and only 5% of that amount came from roadless areas. We could do without that tiny amount of logging to preserve another priceless national treasure. After the announcement, I drove to Fort Myer to receive the traditional farewell tribute from the armed forces, a fine military ceremony that included the presentation of an American flag, a flag with the presidential seal, and medals from each of the service branches. They gave Hillary a medal, too. Bill Cohen noted that in appointing him, I became the only president ever to ask an elected official of the opposite party to become Secretary of Defense. Being president carries no greater honor than being commander-in-chief of men and women of every race and religion who trace their ancestry to every region of the earth. They are the living embodiment of our national creed, E Pluribus Unum. I had seen them cheered in refugee camps in the Balkans, helping the victims of disasters in Central America, working against narco-traffickers in Colombia and the Caribbean, welcomed with open arms in the former communist nations of Central Europe, manning distant outposts in Alaska, standing guard in the deserts of the Middle East, and patrolling the Pacific. Americans know about our forces when they go into battle. There will never be a full account of the wars never fought, the losses never suffered, the tears never shed because American men and women stood guard for peace. I may have gotten off to a rocky start with the military, but I worked hard at being commander-in-chief, and I was confident that I was leaving our military in better shape than I found it. On Saturday, January 6th, after a visit to the National Zoo to see the pandas, Hillary and I held a farewell party on the South Lawn with Al and Tipper for all the people who had worked or volunteered in the White House over the past 8 years. Hundreds of people came, many from long distances. We talked and reminisced for several hours. Al got a rousing welcome when I introduced him as the people's choice in the recent election. When he asked for a show of hands of all the people who had married or had children during our time in the White House, I was amazed at the number of hands that shot up. No matter what the Republicans said, we were a pro-family party. The White House Social Secretary, Capricia Marshall, who had supported me since 1991 and had been with Hillary since early in our first campaign, had arranged a special surprise for me. The curtain behind us rose to reveal Fleetwood Mac singing "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow" one more time. On Sunday, Hillary, Chelsea, and I went to Foundry United Methodist Church, where the Reverend Phil Wagaman invited Hillary and me to make farewell remarks to the congregation that had embraced us for 8 years. Chelsea had made good friends there and had learned a lot working in a distant hollow of rural Kentucky on the church's Appalachian Service Project. The church members came from many races and nations and were rich and poor, straight and gay, old and young. Foundry had supported Washington's homeless population and refugees in parts of the world where I tried to make peace. I didn't know what I was going to say, but Wagaman had told the congregation that I would tell them what I anticipated my new life would be like. So I said my faith would be tested by a return to commercial air travel and that I would be disoriented by walking into large rooms because no band would be playing Hail to the Chief. And I said I would do whatever I could to be a good citizen, to lift the hopes and fortunes of those who deserve a better hand than they have been dealt, and to keep working for peace and reconciliation. Despite my best efforts for the last 8 years, that kind of work still seemed to be in strong demand. Later that night in New York City, I spoke to the Pro-Peace Israel Policy Forum. At the time, we still had some hope of making peace. Arafat had said he accepted the parameters with reservations. The problem was that his reservations, unlike Israel's, were outside the parameters, at least on refugees and the Western Wall. But I treated the acceptance as if it were real, based on his pledge to make peace before I left office. The American Jewish community had been very good to me. Some, like my friend Chaim Sabin and Danny Abraham, were deeply involved with Israel and had given me helpful advice over the years. Many others simply supported my work for peace. Regardless of what happened, I thought I owed it to them to explain my proposal. The next day, after presenting the Citizens Medal to 28 deserving Americans, including Muhammad Ali, I went over to the Democratic Party headquarters to thank the chairman, Mayor Ed Rendell of Philadelphia, and Joe Andrew, and to give a plug to Terry McAuliffe, who had done so much for Al Gore and for me, and who was now campaigning to be the new party chair. After all the work he had done, I couldn't believe Terry wanted the job, but if he did, I was for him. I told the people who'd slaved away at the party work without glory or recognition how much I appreciated them. On the 9th, I began a farewell tour to the places that had been especially good to me. Michigan and Illinois, where victories in the primaries on St. Patrick's Day 1992 had virtually assured me of the nomination. 2 days later, I went to Massachusetts, which gave me the highest percentage of any state in 96, and to New Hampshire, where they had made me the comeback kid in early 1992. In between, I dedicated a statue of Franklin Roosevelt in his wheelchair at the FDR Memorial on the Mall. The disability community had lobbied hard for it, and most of the Roosevelt family had supported it. Of the more than 10,000 photos of FDR in his archives, only 4 depict him in his wheelchair. Disabled Americans had come a long way since then. I said farewell to New Hampshire in Dover, where almost 9 years earlier I had promised to be with them till the last dog dies. Many of my old supporters were in the audience. I called several by name and thanked them all, then gave them a full account of the record their hard work in that long-ago winter had made possible. And I asked them never to forget that even though I won't be president, I'll always be with you until the last dog dies. On the 11th through the 14th, I had parties for the cabinet, the White House staff, and friends at Camp David. On the night of the 14th, Don Henley gave us a wonderful solo concert after dinner in the Camp David chapel. The next morning was our family's last Sunday in the beautiful chapel, where we had shared many services with the fine young sailors and Marines who staffed the camp and their families. They had even let me sing in the choir, always leaving the sheet music in Aspen, our family cabin, on Friday or Saturday so that I could review it in advance. On Monday, I spoke at the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday celebration at the University of the District of Columbia. Usually, I mark the day by doing some community service work, but I wanted to take this opportunity to thank the District of Columbia for being my home for 8 years. The D.C. representative in Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, and Mayor Tony Williams were good friends of mine, as were several city council members. I had worked to help them get needed legislation through Congress and to prevent unduly meddlesome laws from being enacted. The district still had a lot of problems, but it was in much better condition than it had been 8 years earlier when I took my pre-inaugural walk down Georgia Avenue. I also sent my last message to Congress, the unfinished work of building One America. It was based in large part on the final report of the Commission on Race and included a wide array of recommendations. Further steps to close the racial divide in education, health care, employment, and the criminal justice system. Special efforts to help low-income absent fathers succeed at parenting. New investments for Native American communities. Improved immigration policies, passage of the hate crimes bill, reform of the voting laws, and the continuation of AmeriCorps and the White House Office on One America. We had made a lot of headway in 8 years, but America was growing more diverse and there was still much to be done. On the 17th, I held my last ceremony in the East Room as Bruce Babbitt and I announced 8 more national monuments, two of them along the trail Lewis and Clark blazed in 1803 with their Indian guide Sacajawea and a slave named York. We had now protected more land in the lower 48 states than any administration since that of Theodore Roosevelt. After the announcement, I left the White House on the last trip of my presidency, going home to Little Rock to address the Arkansas legislature. Some of my old pals were still in the State House or Senate, as were people who had gotten their start in politics working with me, and a few who began by working against me. More than 20 Arkansans who were then serving or had served with me in Washington joined me that day, as did three of my high school classmates who lived in the Washington area, and several Arkansans who had served as my liaisons to the legislature when I was governor. Chelsea came with me, too. We passed two of her schools on the way in from the airport, and I thought of how much she had grown up since Hillary and I had attended her school programs at Booker Arts Magnet School. I tried to thank all the Arkansans who had helped me reach this day, beginning with two men who were no longer living, Judge Frank Holt and Senator Fulbright. I urged the legislators to keep pushing the federal government to support the states on education, economic development, health care, and welfare reform. Finally, I told my old friends that I would leave office in 3 days, grateful that somehow the mystery of this great democracy gave me the chance to go from a little boy on South Hervey Street in Hope, Arkansas, to the White House. I may be the only person ever elected president who owed his election purely to his personal friends, without whom I could never have won. I left my friends and flew home to finish the job. The next night, after a day working on last-minute business, I gave a brief farewell address to the nation from the Oval Office. After thanking the American people for giving me the chance to serve, and briefly summarizing my philosophy and record, I offered three observations about the future, saying that we should stay on the path to fiscal responsibility, that our security and prosperity required us to lead in the fight for prosperity and freedom and against terrorism, organized crime, narco-trafficking, the spread of deadly weapons, environmental degradation, disease, and global poverty. And finally, that we must continue to weave the threads of our coat of many colors into the fabric of one America. I wished President-elect Bush and his family well and said I would leave the presidency more idealistic, more full of hope than the day I arrived, and more confident than ever that America's best days lie ahead. On the 19th, my last full day as president, I issued a statement on landmines, saying that since 1993, the United States had destroyed more than 3.3 million of our own landmines, spent $500 million to remove landmines in 35 countries, and was making a vigorous effort to find a sensible alternative to mines that would protect our troops as well. I asked the new administration to continue our global demining effort for 10 more years. When I got back to the residence, it was late, and we still weren't completely packed. There were boxes everywhere, and I still had to decide which clothes were going where, to New York, Washington, or Arkansas. Hillary and I didn't want to sleep. We just wanted to keep strolling from room to room. We felt as honored to be living in the White House on our last night as we had when we came home after our first inaugural balls. I never ceased to be thrilled by it all. It seemed almost unbelievable that it had been our home for 8 years. Now it was almost over. I went back into the Lincoln bedroom and read Lincoln's handwritten copy of the Gettysburg Address one last time, and stared at the lithograph of him signing the Emancipation Proclamation on the very spot where I was standing. I went into the Queen's room and thought of Winston Churchill spending 3 weeks there in the difficult days of World War II. I sat behind the treaty table in my office, looking at the empty bookshelves and bare walls, thinking of all the meetings and calls I'd had in that room on Northern Ireland, the Middle East, Russia, Korea, and domestic struggles. And it was in this room where I read my Bible and books and letters, and prayed for strength and guidance all through 1998. Earlier in the day, I had pre-recorded my final radio address to be aired not long before I was to leave the White House for the inaugural ceremony. In it, I thanked the White House staff, the resident staff, the Secret Service, the Cabinet, and Al Gore for all they had done to make my service possible. And I kept my promise to work until the last hour of the last day, releasing another $100 million to fund more police officers. Those new police had helped give America the lowest crime rate in a quarter century. Well past midnight, I went back to the Oval Office again to clean up, pack, and answer a few letters. As I sat alone at the desk, I thought about all that had happened during the last 8 years and how quickly it would be over. Soon I would observe the transfer of power and take my leave. Hillary, Chelsea, and I would board Air Force One for a last flight with the fine crew that had taken us to the far corners of the world, our closest staff members, my new Secret Service detail, some of the career military staff such as Glenn Mays, the Navy steward who had baked all my specially decorated birthday cakes, and Glenn Powell, the Air Force sergeant who made sure our luggage never got lost, and a few of the folks who brought me to the dance, the Jordans, the McAuliffes, the McLartys, and Harry Thomason. Several members of the press corps were also scheduled to make the last trip. One of them, Mark Noller of CBS Radio, had covered me all 8 years and had conducted one of the many wrap-up interviews I had done in the past several weeks. Mark had asked me if I was afraid that the best part of your life is over. I said I had enjoyed every part of my life and that in each stage I had been absorbed, interested, and found something useful to do. I was looking forward to my new life, to building my library, doing public service work through my foundation, supporting Hillary, and having more time for reading, golf, music, and unhurried travel. I knew I would enjoy myself and believed that if I stayed healthy, I could still do a lot of good. But Mark Noller had hit a soft spot with his question. I was going to miss my old job. I had loved being president, even on the bad days. I thought about the note to President Bush I would write and leave behind in the Oval Office, just as his father had done for me 8 years earlier. I wanted to be gracious and encouraging, as George Bush had been to me. Soon George W. Bush would be president of all the people, and I wished him well. I had paid close attention to what Bush and Cheney had said in the campaign. I knew they saw the world very differently from the way I did and would want to undo much of what I had done, especially on economic policy and the environment. I thought that they would pass their big tax cut and that before long we would be back to the big deficits of the 1980s, and in spite of Bush's encouraging comments on education and AmeriCorps, he would feel pressure to cut back on all domestic spending, including education, child care, after-school programs, police on the streets, innovative research, and the environment. But those were not my calls to make anymore. I thought that the international partnerships that we had developed in the aftermath of the Cold War could be strained by the more unilateral approach of the Republicans. They were opposed to the Test Ban Treaty, the Climate Change Treaty, the ABM Treaty, and the International Criminal Court. I had watched the Washington Republicans for 8 years and imagined that President Bush would, from the outset of his term, be under pressure to abandon compassionate conservatism by the more right-wing leaders and interest groups now in control of his party. They believed in their way as deeply as I believed in mine, but I thought the evidence and the weight of history favored our side. I couldn't control what happened to my policies and programs. Few things are permanent in politics, nor could I affect the early judgments of my so-called legacy. The history of America's move from the end of the Cold War to the millennium would be written and rewritten over and over. The only thing that mattered to me about my presidency was whether I had done a good job for the American people in a new and very different era of global interdependence. Had I helped to form a more perfect union by widening the circle of opportunity, deepening the meaning of freedom, and strengthening the bonds of community? I had certainly tried to make America the 21st century's leading force for peace and prosperity, freedom and security. I had tried to put a more human face on globalization by urging other nations to join us in building a more integrated world of shared responsibilities, shared benefits, and shared values. And I had tried to lead America through its transition into this new era with a sense of hope and optimism about what we could do, and a sober sense of what the new forces of destruction could do to us. Finally, I had tried to build up a new progressive politics rooted in new ideas and old values, and to support like-minded movements around the world. No matter how many of my specific initiatives the new administration and its congressional majority might undo, I believed that if we were on the right side of history, the direction I had taken into the new millennium would eventually prevail. On my last night in the now barren Oval Office, I thought of the glass case I had kept on the coffee table between the two couches just a few feet away. It contained a rock Neil Armstrong had taken off the moon in 1969. Whenever arguments in the Oval Office heated up beyond reason, I would interrupt and say, "You see that rock? It's 3.6 billion years old. We're all just passing through. Let's calm down and go back to work." That moon rock gave me a whole different perspective on history and the proverbial long run. Our job is to live as well and as long as we can, and to help others to do the same. What happens after that and how we are viewed by others is beyond our control. The river of time carries us all away. All we have is the moment. Whether I had made the most of mine was for others to judge. It was almost dawn when I returned to the residence to do some more packing and share some private moments with Hillary and Chelsea. The next morning I returned to the Oval Office to write my note to President Bush. Hillary came down too. We gazed out the windows to take a long, admiring look at the beautiful grounds where we had shared so many memorable times, and I had thrown countless tennis balls to Buddy. Then she left me to write my letter. As I placed the letter on the desk, I called my staff in to say goodbye. We hugged, smiled, shed a few tears, and took a few pictures. Then I walked out of the Oval Office for the last time. As I stepped out the door with my arms opened wide, I was greeted by members of the press there to capture the moment. John Podesta walked with me down the colonnade to join Hillary, Chelsea, and the Gores on the state floor, where we would soon greet our successors. The entire residence staff had gathered to say goodbye. The housekeeping staff, the kitchen staff, the florist, the grounds crew, the ushers, the butlers, my valets. Many of them had become like family. I looked into their faces and stored the memories, not knowing when I would see them again, and knowing that when I did, it would never be quite the same. They would soon have a new family who would need them as much as we had. A small combo from the Marine Band was playing in the grand foyer. I sat down at the piano with Master Sergeant Charlie Corrado, who had played for presidents for 40 years. Charlie was always there for us, and his music had brightened a lot of days. Hillary and I had a last dance, and at about 10:30 the Bushes and the Cheneys arrived. We drank coffee and chatted for a few minutes, then the eight of us got in the limousines and rode with George W. Bush for the drive down Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol. Within an hour, the peaceful transfer of power that has kept our country free for more than 200 years had taken place again. My family said goodbye to the new first family and drove to Andrews Air Force Base for our last flight on the presidential plane that was no longer Air Force One for me. After 8 years as president and half a lifetime in politics, I was a private citizen again, but a very grateful one. Still pulling for my country, still thinking about tomorrow.
I wrote this book to tell my story. and to tell the story of America in the last half of the 20th century. To describe as fairly as I could the forces competing for the country's heart and mind. To explain the challenges of the new world in which we live and how I believe our government and our citizens should best respond to them. And to give people who have never been involved in public life a sense of what it is like to hold office, and especially what it is like to be president. While writing, I found myself falling back in time, reliving events as I recounted them, feeling as I did then, and writing as I felt. During my second term, as the partisan battles I tried to diminish continued unabated, I also tried to understand how my time in office fit into the stream of American history. America's history is largely the story of our efforts to honor our founders' charge, to form a more perfect union. In calmer times, our country has been well served by our two-party system, with progressives and conservatives debating what to change and what to preserve. But when change is forced upon us by events, we are all tested and thrown back to our fundamental mission, to widen the circle of opportunity, deepen the meaning of freedom, strengthen the bonds of our community. To me, that is what it means to make our union more perfect. At every critical turning point, we have chosen union over division. In the early days of the Republic, by building a national economic and legal system. In the Civil War, by preserving the Union and ending slavery. In the early 20th century, as we moved from an agricultural to an industrial society. By making our government stronger to preserve competition, promote basic safeguards for labor, provide for the poor, the elderly, and the infirm, and protect our natural resources from plunder. And in the 1960s and 1970s, by advancing civil rights and women's rights. In each instance, while we were engaged in the struggle to define, defend, and expand our union, powerful conservative forces resisted, and as long as the outcome was in doubt, the political and personal conflicts were intense. In 1993, when I took office, we were facing another historic challenge to the union, as we moved from the industrial age into the global information age. The American people were faced with big changes in the way they lived and worked, and big questions to be answered. Would we choose global economic engagement or economic nationalism? Would we use our unrivaled military, political, and economic power to spread the benefits and confront the emerging threats of the interdependent world, or become a fortress America, acting on our own? Would we abandon our industrial age government with its commitments to equal opportunity and social justice, or reform it to give people the tools to succeed in the new era? Would our increasing racial and religious diversity fracture or strengthen our national community? As president, I tried to answer these questions in a way that kept moving us toward a more perfect union, lifting people's vision and bringing them together to build a new vital center for American politics in the 21st century. 2/3 of the citizens supported my general approach, but on the cultural questions and always appealing tax cuts, the electorate was more closely divided. With the outcome in doubt, the bitter partisan and personal attacks raged, bearing a striking resemblance to those of the early Republic. Whether my historical analysis is right or not, I judge my presidency more in terms of its impact on people's lives. That is how I kept score. All the millions of people with new jobs, new homes, and college aid. The kids with health insurance and after-school programs. The people who left welfare for work. The families helped by the family leave law, the people living in safer neighborhoods, all those people have stories, and they're better ones now. Life got better for all Americans because the air and water were cleaner and more of our natural heritage was preserved, and we brought more hope for peace, freedom, security, and prosperity to people all over the world. They have their stories, too. When I became president, America was sailing into uncharted waters, into a world full of apparently disconnected positive and negative forces. Because I had spent a lifetime trying to bring together my own parallel lives, had been raised to value all people, and as governor had seen both the bright and dark sides of globalization, I felt I understood where my country was and how we needed to move into the new century. I knew how to put things together and how hard it was to do. On September the 11th, things seemed to fall apart again, as Al-Qaeda used the forces of interdependence, open borders, easy immigration and travel, easy access to information and technology, to murder 3,100 people from 70 nations in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania. The world rallied around President Bush and the American people in our determination to fight terror. In the years since, the battle has been intensified, with understandable and honestly held differences about how best to do it. The interdependent world we live in is inherently unstable, full of opportunity and destruction. It will remain so until we find our way from interdependence to a more integrated global community of shared responsibilities, shared benefits, and shared values. Building that kind of world and defeating terror cannot be done quickly. It will be the great challenge of the first half of the 21st century. I believe there are five things the United States should be doing to lead the way. First, fighting terror and the spread of weapons of mass destruction and improving our defenses to them. Second, making more friends and fewer terrorists by helping the 50% of the world not reaping the benefits of globalization to overcome poverty, ignorance, disease, and bad government. Third, strengthening the institutions of global cooperation and working through them to promote security and prosperity and to combat our shared problems, from terror to AIDS to global warming. Fourth, continuing to make America a better model of how we want the world to work. And fifth, working to end the age-old compulsion to believe our differences are more important than our common humanity. I believe the world will continue its forward march from isolation to interdependence to cooperation, because there is no other choice. We have come a long way since our ancestors first stood up on the African savanna more than 100,000 years ago. In just the 15 years since the end of the Cold War, the West has been largely reconciled to its old adversaries, Russia and China. More than half the world's people are living under governments of their own choosing for the first time in history. There has been an unprecedented degree of global cooperation against terror, and a recognition that we must do more to fight poverty, disease, and global warming, and to get all the world's children in school. And America and many other free societies have shown that people of all races and religions can live together in mutual respect and harmony. Our nation will not be undone by terror. We will defeat it, but we must take care that in so doing, we do not compromise the character of our country or the future of our children. Our mission to form a more perfect union is now a global one. I'm still working on that list of life goals I made as a young man. Becoming a good person is a lifelong effort that requires letting go of anger at others and holding on to responsibility for the mistakes I've made. And it requires forgiveness. After all the forgiveness I've been given from Hillary, Chelsea, my friends, and millions of people in America and across the world, it's the least I can do. When I started going to black churches as a young politician, for the first time I heard people refer to funerals as homegoings. We're all going home, and I want to be ready. In the meantime, I take great joy in the life Chelsea is building, the superb job Hillary's doing in the Senate, and the work I'm doing through my foundation to bring economic, educational, and service opportunities to poor communities in America and across the world, to fight AIDS and bring low-cost medicine to those who need it, and to continue my commitment to racial and religious reconciliation. Do I have regrets? Sure, both private and public ones, and I've outlined them in this book. I'll leave it to others to judge how to balance the scales. I've just tried to tell the story of my joys and sorrows, dreams and fears, triumphs and failures. And I've tried to explain the difference between my view of the world and those on the far right with whom I did battle. In essence, they honestly believe they know the whole truth. I see things differently. I think St. Paul had it right when he said that in this life we see through a glass darkly and know in part. That's why he extolled the virtues of faith, hope, and love. I've had an improbable life, and a wonderful one, full of faith, hope, and love, as well as more than my share of grace and good fortune. As improbable as my life has been, it would have been impossible anywhere but America. Unlike so many people, I've been privileged to spend every day working for things I've believed in since I was a little boy hanging around my grandfather's store. I grew up with a fascinating mother who adored me, learned at the feet of great teachers, made a legion of loyal friends, built a loving life with the finest woman I've ever known, and had a child who continues to be the light of my life. As I said, I think it's a pretty good story, and I had a good time telling it. Bill Clinton, Westchester County, May 2004.
We hope you've enjoyed this production of My Life by William Jefferson Clinton. This book was read by Michael Beck, with a prologue and epilogue read by the author. My Life was produced by Dan Musselman and directed by Gabrielle DeCure. Text copyright 2004 by William Jefferson Clinton. Production copyright 2004, Books on Tape.